Hi, everybody. This is Joanne Manister, Science Goddess on Twitter, with my co-host Jeff Schomeyer of Read Science. And today we welcome Jason Fagoni, who has written a marvelous book, one that I could not put down when I got it. It's called The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. And yes, I look forward to a discussion with you, Jason. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about you. You are an American journalist and author. Your work has appeared in GQ, Wired, Esquire, The Atlantic, New York, New York Times, Huffington Post, and more. And you have two other books. Your first book has two names I saw. One is Horsemen of the Esophagus, about competitive eating. But what's the alternate title? Was that in the UK or something?
I think it was called Insatiable.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah. And so maybe
people have asked me if there's something that links that book about competitive eating with this book that I wrote about puzzle-solving heroine of the World Wars. And the answer is no.
No.
There's nothing that connects them other than the fact that that I wrote them.
That you wrote them. And then your other book, your second book, before this one, is called Ingenious, A True Story of Invention, Automotive Daring, and The Race to Revive America, about teams in the Progressive Automotive XPRIZE.
So. Yeah, that's getting a little bit closer to the topic of the woman who smashed codes. We're now with Ingenious, we're talking about science, we're talking about engineering, and we're talking about building things, which is very much sort of the spirit at the heart of the book we're going to talk about today.
Ah, that's good. I'm going to let Jeff ask his question because he normally gets to ask the first question, but now I've thought of one I need to ask you. So, Jeff, take it away. I'm writing my question down.
Okay. You've given us here a really interesting, very comprehensive, written and researched biography of a woman that nobody's ever heard of up until now. And I think the question underneath here that I'm really interested in is hearing about your research and stories about that. What I'm particularly interested in is what things happened that made it possible to do the research now, which is tied pretty much to why we have never heard of Elizabeth Friedman before. But I think maybe to start, I might have to say, can you give us the quick sketch of who she is and what she's done, just enough to start hanging these details on about why we've never heard of her yet?
Yes. So Elizabeth Friedman is, I think, one of the most important Americans that most people have never heard of. Mm-hmm. She helped invent the modern science of cryptology, codes and ciphers, that is at the foundation of our powerful intelligence agencies. So the NSA, CIA, FBI, at the core of these agencies is the science of cryptology. And Elizabeth was one of the pioneers of this science in the early 20th century. She also used that science to do a series of incredibly dramatic things. For instance, during the 20s and 30s, she intercepted and solved encrypted radio messages that were sent by rum runners and drug smugglers. And so she was basically fighting the rum war using her knowledge as a code breaker. Excuse me. And then in World War II, she used her abilities to hunt Nazis, particularly Nazi spies. She intercepted and solved the encrypted radio messages of Nazi spies, helped destroy these rings, eliminated dangerous threat to America during the war. And then all of that time, she was also the sort of the life partner, helpmate, and muse of a guy who later became very famous, a guy who is considered to be the founder of the National Security Agency, a guy named William Friedman. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that behind the story of the American intelligence community, its growth and its rise, there's actually this remarkable hidden woman, a code-breaking Quaker poet that nobody had ever heard of. And for me as a journalist and a writer, to find a story like that, to kind of stumble on it in the way that I did, is one of the best things that can possibly happen to you.
We don't know her because she's been subjected to so many different types of suppression. She was the one doing all of these things. And I I think you've convinced me that she's really the stronger, more creative of the partnership with her husband, even though her husband did important things on his own. But you had a telling story about people who would come and try to talk to her, hoping that she would talk to her husband, so they thought, in order to solve some problems, but really she was the one doing it. And so she's subjected to these, what we now see as horribly sexist preconceptions that said, you know, just she could not be the one who was doing anything and it must be her husband. Plus the fact that virtually everything she did is classified and extremely secretly handled and everything up until very recently, right? So it's only, as the headlines might say, it's only now that this story can start to come out. We can start to see who this incredible person was, right? This right. is all this stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. So Jeff, you put your finger on the two things that have made her story hidden for so many years. One thing is sexism, right. And the other thing is secrecy. And so on the sexism front, you know, all through her career, she was surrounded by men who ended up getting the credit for things that she did and contributed to. And sometimes it was just because there were men close to her who she loved who ended up overshadowing her because mm-hmm. of the sexism of the culture. As this was the case with her partnership with William Friedman. And in other cases, they were men who were powerful men who actively stole credit mm-hmm. from her for things that she did. I mean, the most famous case of this is the thing that I discovered in the book, which is, you know, she was essentially the technical engine, mm-hmm. the secret weapon in World War II for J. Edgar Hoover in his hunt for Nazi spies in the Western Hemisphere. And yet, after the war, we can talk more about this later if you want, Hoover took the credit for her accomplishments and her feats of code breaking. But yeah, I mean, so beyond the sexism, she was working on incredibly secret projects, especially during World War II, that were locked in government tombs for about 50 or 60 years. They were classified. You know, I mean, when I finally found after a 2-year search, the records, the now declassified records of her World War II code breaking unit, right. Every page had this big, fearsome looking black stamp at the top that said, Top Secret Ultra. And yeah. Every single page, Top Secret Ultra. Ultra was one of the biggest secrets of the war. And so, you know, for the longest time, we didn't know the story because it was literally hidden under lock and key. But I think that, like you said, you know, initially government agencies would approach Elizabeth with sort of a sexist pitch. They would go to her, you know, hoping to use the brain of the great William Friedman kind of secondhand because they knew that William and Elizabeth had this kind of incredible intellectual bond. And yes. So they would try to get access to the powerful sort of computer of William's brain by leasing time in Elizabeth's brain. And she resented that a little bit, you know, she thought that was sad for her, but the same thing happened every time, which is that, you know, after this kind of initial sexist pitch, Elizabeth would accept the job and go to work for government agencies solving puzzles. And very quickly, the people that she was working for would realize, oh my gosh, she's a master in her own right. And then they'd give her more and more work. And she very quickly established herself as an expert wherever she went. And I mean, she was actually so good that it ended up putting up impediments in her own life and her own dreams, because I mean, you know, she had other things that she wanted to do with her life other than work for the U.S. government. She wanted to write children's books. She had two kids. And the problem was she was just so damn good at what she did. I mean, her lifelong complaint was that, you know, the way she put it is men from the government keep showing up on my doorstep asking me to solve puzzles for America. The only way I can make them go away is to say yes and solve these puzzles for them. And the problem for Elizabeth is just that she just had such an unusual set of skills that she became indispensable. And that became her life, is men from the government showing up on her doorstep all the livelong day. And she, you know, out of a sense of duty, continuing to say yes. And that's what kind of drove her her incredible and remarkable career that I think sort of changed the shape of the 20th century.
I think it's
clearly, clearly she didn't start that way. She was a poet. And I remember Jeff and I having a discussion of like, oh my goodness, the way this book starts.
Yes.
You know, being sort of you know, almost accosted and picked up by an eccentric tycoon. It's like, what?
Yeah, it's one of these things that's, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, right? So it's true. Elizabeth was not, I think we tend to think of codebreakers as math geniuses. You know, a codebreaker is just someone who solves a hidden message without having the key. And I think our image is that these are mathematicians, but the thing about Elizabeth is that she started as a poet. She was a literature expert. She had studied English literature at a liberal arts college, you know, reading Shakespeare plays and Tennyson poems. That was her thing. She loved the rhythm of words. And what happened is that she was a bright woman in 1915 when she graduated from college, and the only job that was available to women at that time really was to be a school teacher. That was kind of the end of the line, and so she became a school teacher, and she found it incredibly boring. She got a job as a school teacher in a rural Indiana town, not far from the small Indiana town where she had grown up. And she just wanted something more out of life. She wanted to take a risk, and she had kind of an inner bravery and an inner sort of rebelliousness that was not shared by her eight siblings and her large Quaker family. She was kind of the rebellious one in the family, and so she decided, you know, at age 23, to quit her job and move to the big city, Chicago, and look for something more unusual. And this crazy thing happened when she went there in June 1916, which is, you know, she kind of struck out finding a new job. She went to job agencies. Nobody seemed to have anything. And right before she was about to go home to Indiana in failure, she stopped at a library, the Newberry Library, which happened to have a rare volume of Shakespeare that she had always wanted to see. It was the 1623 first folio, which was the first time that Shakespeare's plays had all been collected. She goes to this library and she's looking at this rare book of Shakespeare, and the librarian comes over to her and says, "Looks like you're interested in Shakespeare." And Elizabeth says, "Yes, I'm very interested in Shakespeare." And the librarian says, "You know, it's a funny thing. There's this very odd rich guy who has been coming to the library a lot lately. And he's been looking with extreme care, poring over the pages of the same book that you're looking at now. He thinks that there are hidden messages in the works of Shakespeare that have been written in cipher by the true author, who is actually not William Shakespeare. He thinks it's this guy, one of Shakespeare's contemporaries, Francis Bacon." And the librarian is telling Elizabeth this, and the librarian says, "You know, this odd rich guy says he's looking for a research assistant. Would you be interested in a position like that?" And Elizabeth says, "Oh, possibly." The librarian goes back to the desk, makes a phone call, and within an hour, this odd rich guy pulls up to the front of the library in a chauffeured limousine, comes into the library, stands in front of Elizabeth Friedman. By the way, Elizabeth Friedman is like 5'3". She's very petite, small, delicate. This guy is 6'4", 240 pounds, big iron gray beard, just towering over her. And the first thing he says to her is, "Would you like to come out to Riverbank and spend the night with me?" This really happened. Actually, she told the story many, many times, and it was always the same. It's accurate. And she didn't know what to say. She said, "You know, I don't have any of my night things. I don't have my toothbrush." And he said, "Oh, don't worry about that. We'll provide all of that." And he grabbed her by the arm and took her into the limousine, and ended up kind of taking her on the train out to this place called Riverbank, which turned out to be the setting for the first third of my book, The Woman Who Smashed Codes. It's this kind of fantastical, forgotten place. That was created by a guy who was kind of like an Andrew Carnegie or a William Randolph Hearst of his day. He was a Gilded Age multimillionaire who had enough money to create kind of his own world around him. And that's where the book begins, and that's where Elizabeth's kind of adventure begins.
Yeah, what a surprise. And that was, you started it off well, because that was what made it. I'm like, well, now I got to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, she felt the same way. She was offended. She was surprised, but there was something. Her curiosity was triggered. I mean, when this rich guy told her that he had assembled a group of experts from around the world to discover secret messages in Shakespeare, and she's 23 years old, and she's been looking for, she's set out to look for a more unusual job. Well, she has found it. She has found it. Unusual, right? So her curiosity was piqued, and she went along with the game, and she moved out there. She began working for this guy, and very quickly things got extremely strange.
Strange. It didn't disappoint. He was George Fabian is just as weird as he seemed at the very beginning, right? With this fanciful sort of movie set research place where he was doing his own things, and bizarre.
He's like he's almost like a Donald Trump of his day, except instead of caring a lot about TV ratings, what George Fabian cared about was science. He wanted to discover the secrets of nature. That was his personal passion. That was how he spent all of his free time. When he wasn't making a ton of money in the industry, he was thinking about how to reveal the secrets of nature. And so his 350-acre private estate outside of Chicago called Riverbank, he turned it into kind of like half of a rich man's paradise and half a private scientific laboratory. And so, on any given weekend at Riverbank, there might be, you would have the rich guy part. You would have like Teddy Roosevelt stopping by to talk about genetics and agriculture. Or you would have famous actresses of the day sort of sunning themselves on the lawn, Lily Langtry, Billy Burke. And on the other hand, you would have all of these amazing scientists running around performing cutting edge experiments. He hired people who were some of the leading acoustics experts of the day from Harvard. He hired agriculture experts to breed new strains of crops. And one of the people he had hired was this guy, a young Jewish geneticist from Pittsburgh, William Friedman. In 1915, and then Elizabeth Friedman is hired in 1916, the following year, to work on the Shakespeare project. Fairly soon, these two young people are thrown together, and they immediately click. They have a bond, and within a year, they're married, and they're kind of off to the races, soon to become the greatest code-breaking duo in history.
Yeah, because so here's George Fabian, this wacko out here, but he knows people. He knows everyone, it seems like, who want to be known by him. And then World War I comes along, and then there are these secret messages, and somebody has a clever idea, and the U.S. has no code-breaking facility whatsoever. And so stuff happens, and before you know it, here's Elizabeth and William, who are saving the U.S. secretly from Germany, and it's just too incredible.
Stuff happens. I like that. That really is like a pretty accurate encapsulation of that moment. So this was a surprise to me researching the book, is that America had no intelligence community to speak of in 1916 when World War I broke out. I think today, the FBI, CIA, NSA are so large and powerful that we tend to think that they've always been that way, but not at all. I mean, the surprise for me researching the book is that in 1916, there was almost nothing. There was no NSA, there was no CIA, and the FBI was only about 8 years old. It wasn't very large or very powerful at all. And so when World War I broke out, America had no ability to read the secret messages of the enemy. It could not intercept the messages of the enemy and solve them and read them to get intelligence, which is what you need to do in a war. It's very important. And because the War Department, the Army, was so desperate because they just didn't have anybody, they ended up turning to these kind of odd Shakespeare investigators out at Riverbank because they just happened to be some of the only people
secret messages.
Yeah, who could read secret. I mean, Elizabeth said later that there were only about five people in the entire country in 1916 who even knew what the word code or cipher meant. And so the War Department, out of desperation, began to send all of its secret messages to be solved out to the Illinois prairie. And, all of a sudden, this kind of odd literary project of finding secret messages in Shakespeare was transformed into a very urgent military project of discovering what the Germans were saying. And that's how Elizabeth and William got their start as military codebreakers at age 24 or 25. It's an incredible thing. They were so young, but because the field itself was so young, they were kind of the experts, even though they were incredibly young.
And obviously when you're around someone who's sort of eccentric and odd, and you realize, wait, there's more to life than this, so they had to get away somehow.
Yeah, they eventually had to make, I think what happened is, you know, at a certain point, they realized that the Shakespeare Project was a wild goose chase. It was all kind of a, it was an instance of, you know, humans are very good at seeing patterns in noise. Mm-hmm. We're all kind of born to do it. And that's really what code breaking is more than anything. It's about seeing patterns. And the thing with the Shakespeare people is that they were seeing patterns that weren't really there. Sometimes, mm-hmm. sometimes we're so good at seeing patterns that we see things that aren't really there. And it was all kind of a delusion. I think Elizabeth and William looked at each other at some point and they looked at each other and they just thought, like, is everyone else around here completely insane? Like, are we the only, is it possible that we're the only sane people in this entire place? And that really bonded them to each other. And the fact that they began to challenge Fabian, he didn't like that. He was a very mm-hmm. controlling guy. And he started to spy on them. He intercepted their personal mail. He surveilled them. and tried to exert control to prevent them from ever leaving. So ultimately, after the war was over, after Elizabeth and William spent the war serving America, solving these German messages, and also sort of inventing some of the early pieces of what would become, you know, the modern science of cryptology, writing these really important scientific papers together. After the war, they decided to essentially to flee. They packed up their things in the middle of the night.
Yes.
So that Fabian couldn't prevent them from leaving. And at the end of 1920, they lit out for Washington, D.C. To begin a new career together in the nation's capital.
That sort of seemed like a story in itself, but no, that was where things were just getting started. And then stuff happened.
And then more stuff happened.
More yeah. stuff.
And it kept happening.
Yeah, it kept happening.
No, well, I mean, Elizabeth, I mean, this is Elizabeth's sort of constant refrain about her life is she described her career mm-hmm. in codebreaking as, her phrase, pure accident. She mm-hmm. never intended to do any of this. It was just a series of kind of historical accidents that kept flinging her into ever more kind of, you know, dramatic and high mm-hmm. stakes situations mm-hmm. that she had to, you know, think herself out of.
Now, but then in a while, we're going to find out how she ends up working, of all things, for the Coast Guard, which is like, takes half the book. And I was like, really? Yeah. But there's so much before there. And I'm thinking there were several times in the book when we sort of seemed to be over here doing background for what was happening with Elizabeth. And I was very happy about that because I found I kept saying, I didn't even know that. It's like I hadn't been aware of the whole thing about rum running and what an incredibly big operation, what a serious operation that was.
Right.
So the background there was useful. And one that struck me similarly was, I don't think I knew about the whole Nazi infiltration, trying to form a revolution in South America, all of the radio networks. Yeah. It's like, I had no idea about how important any of those things were, but.
And I was going to say, this is one thing I really liked about this book was I love when books inform me of something. I'm like, oh, you know, maybe I've heard of it, but not very well informed about it. You know, so, like it's meant rum runner and you go, oh, yeah, I sort of know what a rum runner is.
But so I've got the impression that Jason was hearing about these, learning about these things for the first time. And maybe that's useful not to know the subject so well. You can be surprised by that.
Well, for sure. I mean, I'm an outsider to the world of cryptology. I think I was approaching this always with an outsider's eye and learning myself, which is part of what made it so much fun. And one of the reasons I love being a journalist and a writer is because it's kind of a way to constantly be teaching yourself new things, right? As a way of living.
Without an exam or, well, you always have a paper to write, but.
Well, you're always going to write. You got to show your work. But absolutely, that's true about rum running. I mean, I think I had this impression, hearing about rum running over the years, I had this impression of a rum runner as sort of like a gentleman, you know, a guy on a boat, doing it for the love of being out in the fresh air and kind of the adventure of it and, you know, making a little bit of money on the side. And it's kind of a noble thing. And no, that's not what it was at all. I mean, it was like that for the first couple of years of Prohibition. But very quickly, what happened by about 1924 and 1925 is that, you know, vast criminal syndicates figured out there was enormous money to be made, and they forced the gentlemen rum runners out of business. If you've ever heard the phrase "the real McCoy," that actually dates back to rum running. There really was a rum captain named Bill McCoy. He was kind of the archetypal gentleman rum runner. And in his memoir, he talks about being forced out of the business by a criminal mafia from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And so the gentlemen were kicked out by the mob. And the mob approach to rum running was very much like the mob approach to anything else, which is you do it at scale, you do it with weapons, you do it with guns, you do it by killing people, you do it by intimidating people, you do it with extortion and embezzlement and fraud. And these were criminal syndicates that, you know, by the middle part of the 1920s encircled the entire globe. There was one criminal syndicate in particular based out of Vancouver, Canada, called Consolidated Exporters Corporation, that essentially had its own navy that would have been the envy of many countries. They had about 60 or 70 ships that encircled the entire globe and brought rum from all parts of the world, West Coast, East Coast, Gulf of Mexico. There was nowhere that these ships were not. And they had about 40 or 50 different codes and ciphers that were all very strong and changing all the time, because they had enough money that they were able to hire a British expert cryptographer who had worked for the British Navy during World War I. And so when Elizabeth started to look at some of these rum running codes in the mid-1920s, when she first went to work for the Coast Guard, after the men from the government showed up on her doorstep and said, "Please help us." Yes. You know, she's looking at these things for the Coast Guard, and she's realizing, oh my gosh, this is the sophistication level of these rum running codes is very high. And so so it took her a long time to really kind of dig into these networks, but eventually she did, because she was extremely patient, she was extremely smart and creative and tenacious, and ultimately she was able to sort of draw a map of this hidden underworld. She was able to use code breaking and radio intelligence, that is, intercepting these radio messages that rum runners were sending, solving them, decrypting the encrypted messages, and then reading the messages to learn what these rum runners were saying to each other and who they were. Who are these guys? What are the names of the captains? What are the names of their boats? Where do they go? What do their networks look like? She was essentially mapping a hidden criminal underworld network, throwing light on the dark. This is the discipline that we call counterintelligence. I mean, she counterintelligence, the art of figuring out what a hidden network of spies is saying to each other. Counterintelligence is in the news every day today because of the Trump-Russia investigation. That began as an FBI counterintelligence investigation. What are these spies saying to each other? Just trying to figure it out.
But a simple statement that, you know, and then Elizabeth went to work doing code breaking for the Coast Guard of messages by rum runners, just sounds ridiculous without the whole story of how huge the rum running business was, why it was that the IRS was involved, why it was that the Coast Guard was an important part of the IRS, why it was that the Coast Guard got involved with code breaking of all things, was because of this, because the story was, the enterprise was so huge.
And I learned about that too, is sort of the primacy of the Treasury Department in the 1920s and 1930s, which is really interesting. So the Treasury Department, its agents were called T-men, as opposed to the G-men of the FBI. And so if you start to look at it through the lens of T-men, it's actually, the Treasury Department is actually then and now an intelligence community all its own. It's a huge department that contains six different intelligence agencies. I'll see if I can list them. It's narcotics, prohibition, IRS, Secret Service, Coast Guard, and customs.
And customs.
So it had six law enforcement agencies. They all needed to do the work at some point of breaking hidden messages, and yet there was no code breaking department within the Treasury. So Elizabeth became kind of like the nexus for all six of these agencies. Whenever any of these T-men needed a message solved, they would, the word was, send for Mrs. Friedman and she'll solve it. And so she became kind of the touch point for all of these places. I mean, the volume of what she was doing was so impressive to me. Like you said, it was a massive operation, rum running, and it required a massive response, even though she only had one clerk between she only had one staff person beneath her from 1925 to 1931, which is incredible to think about. So for 6 years, Elizabeth and this clerk typist, another woman, these two women were handling the entire code breaking burden of fighting the rum war for the US government. And it involved solving about 20,000 different rum messages a year. And if you think about that, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
20,000 a year. Yeah. You break up
not,
your
and
day.
It's not computerized. I mean, we're talking a computer. I mean, everything is computers today, but this is before the digital computer. And so all you had to work with was, you know, your pencil, your paper, and your mind.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And pencil and paper actually mean pencil and paper too.
Yeah, exactly. So like they Elizabeth eventually, and I guess William too, thought, you know, more people need to know about this. And they're working on a book, they created classes, right?
So from the very beginning of their career, they were called upon to teach code breaking just because there were so few code breakers. So even starting in World War One, you know, about a year after Elizabeth first learned to break code, she became a teacher of, you know, 100 young army captains, teaching them how to break codes at Riverbank. And that teaching continued all throughout their career because, you know, they were two of the primary experts in America.
They had the character of researchers, scientific researchers is something we can learn about. They learn things, and when you learn things, you tell people about things, and you teach people about it. You share that as much as they could.
I think so, and that's an interesting thing to point out. I always felt very strongly that they were fundamentally teachers and scientists at heart, and like you say, they wanted to share their knowledge, what they could. A lot of things they couldn't share, you know, a lot of things they had to keep secret, but they also all their lives wrote about different aspects of code breaking, because I think they thought that, you know, in a democracy, people need to know what the government is doing. Mm-hmm. And if you can't share specific details about, you know, secret investigations, which they never did, at the very least, people in a democracy ought to know sort of what the government, what kind of science the government is applying, and what they wanted people to understand code breaking and to be able to play around with it. I mean, they always had fun with it. They to them, code breaking was a game, always. I mean, they would send holiday letters to their friends that were some original types of puzzles. You know, they would send. Little cryptograms to their friends at the holidays that their friends would then solve, and there would be a holiday message. Some of these were so elaborate. I would be researching, you know, some aspect of their lives in the archive where they left their papers in Virginia, and all of a sudden I would come across this like little puzzle, and I would have to pause for an hour to try to figure it out. What are they trying to say here? And I would just get engrossed with it. And they were really fun, but they held these cipher parties all through the 30s. They would invite people over to their house, and you know, Elizabeth would cook like an elaborate 5-course dinner, and the menu would be themed around crypto things. And so you would have to solve a little cryptogram to get your appetizer, and then solve another one to get your main course. And,
I remember the Blue Point oysters.
Yeah, right. There was a wife, an army wife, who came to one of the parties and was worried that she wouldn't be able to solve anything. And all of the men were sitting around the table trying to solve this little puzzle that was written in little period dots of blue pen. And all of a sudden it occurred to her, oh, blue points. They're gonna say blue point oysters. And she got the answer when all of these sort of like crypto officers for the army had struck out. They were teachers to the extent that they could teach. And then after World War II, what happened is the government had a very different view of what was okay to share publicly about the science of code breaking. And this was, you know, in the 1950s, the Red Scare, McCarthyism, you know, and the beginning of the Cold War. And everything in Washington kind of shut down and became much, much, much more secret. There was much more classification. And this really troubled William and Elizabeth. And, you know, to the extent that they pushed back, they were kind of ostracized. And ultimately, they became estranged from the government after a really sad incident in 1958. when the NSA, which was an agency that, you know, we kind of skipped over some of the World War II timeline, but that's all right. NSA is, you know, an agency that they, I mean, they're kind of like the Adam and Eve of the NSA, right? Like they helped to, you know, they laid the groundwork for it. Williams' army unit that he started in 1930 became the core of the NSA when it was founded in 1952. You know, they helped to build this thing, and then the NSA turned on them. In 1958, it came to their house, their private house, and took, you know, boxes of their own files from their own private library and reclassified them, including things going all the way back to World War I, which the Freedmans found, you know, humiliating, embarrassing, and intolerable from the standpoint of just sort of the democratic urge and you know, feeling that certain things should be public in a democracy. And so at that point, they started to think about how they could protect their papers from the government and make them available to future generations of researchers. And the only reason that I was able to write this book, really, and other people have been able to write about the history of American code breaking, is because the Freedmans, as a middle finger to Uncle Sam, decided to give all of their papers to a private library in Virginia. And that's why I could go in, you know, 3 years ago and start to look at their papers, because they had that foresight and they wanted people to know the story.
It's amazing.
So they were, I'm sorry. So they were only code breakers. And in fact, I remember on Twitter, I had promoted your book just before it came out. And someone said something about Simon Singh, because of course he wrote the code book.
Sure. Yep.
And Simon Singh pipes in and says, "Our office doesn't make them, we only break them."
Right. That's what Elizabeth said in the run-up to World War II. It was somebody approached her and asked her team to make a series of codes, and she quipped, you know, we don't make them, we only break them.
But okay, so before we commit totally to World War II, which is a huge thing, I wanted to know for a bit, Elizabeth had a brief period of celebrity thanks to the rum-running work and the trials that followed, and well, that was a very interesting episode too. And so there was a little moment when people actually knew about her. And did people really believe that she? A lot of people didn't believe still that she was the one doing all of this, right?
Well, I think people started to believe when they saw her appearing at trials testifying against gangsters. And this started to happen in the early 1930s. So Elizabeth, in her work on the Rum War, she would solve these messages of rum runners. And then the prosecutors would want to put these guys on trial based on her solutions. That meant that she had to appear in front of a jury and explain how she had gotten these solutions. Because if she didn't go and testify and explain the science of code breaking and convince a jury that these solutions really were the real words of rum runners, that she had essentially stolen their thoughts, if she didn't explain that, it just seemed like magic.
Yeah.
And if she didn't explain it, then it was very easy for defense attorneys to come in and say, "Oh, this is all just gobbledygook. This is all just mumbo jumbo.
All made up.
There's no science here at all. This is ridiculous." Mm-hmm. So prosecutors would call in Elizabeth, and she would get on the stand, and she would have some fierce, you know, criminals of her day, and she would explain to the jury, you know, what code breaking was, what the science was, and how she did all of these things. She, you know, she went face to face with Al Capone's attorney at a famous trial in New Orleans in 1933. You know, facing down more than 20 agents of this huge rum syndicate from Vancouver, Consolidated Exporters Corporation. You know, and she beat them, and she, you know, she beat these guys again and again. You know, she got convictions, and then she would, you know, get her bag. I mean, she always appeared, you know, I mean, at some of these trials, she would wear like at one of the trials, she wore a pink dress and a pink hat with a flower pinned to the brim. I mean, it was for newspaper reporters, it was irresistible. It was absolutely had total headline material. And she became a front page story because of these spectacular testimonies. You know, I mean, they called her the pretty little woman who protects the United States, pretty, you know, a pretty government code reader, a pretty government script analyst. I mean, she was big news, and she didn't particularly like it, because she hated journalists. She thought journalists were sort of like a lesser tribe of she thought they their code, professional code, was less rigorous than hers. And she's really right about that. but yeah, she was a very modest person, and she didn't really like sort of star worship, and it made her very uncomfortable. And I think when, you know, toward World War II, when she began to work on this ultra secret project for the government, and she was no longer allowed to appear in public and talk about her work, I think it was kind of a private relief for her, because she had not really enjoyed her period of celebrity, but she was very famous for a time.
Amazing. Amazing.
We're dumbfounded. Well, okay. So here we are in World War II, and we can talk about how that got started and how that sort of separated William from...
Yeah. That's going to be my question.
From Elizabeth, yeah. And then how they continued to grow apart until you had, you know, the most poignant story sort of at the end of this, where they had both done amazing things, none of which they could talk about with each other.
Yeah, it was difficult. So they were both working for different parts of the government on very important, high stakes, secret projects that had to stay at work. So William, during World War II, was running an army team that was breaking the cipher machines of the Japanese government. The Japanese were giving diplomats a cipher machine. It was kind of like the Japanese version of the Enigma machine, if you've heard of Enigma.
Yes.
Cipher machine, for those who don't know, is like a typewriter with sort of a mechanism inside that changes one letter to another in a very complicated way that can't be guessed by an adversary through brute force methods. So William and his team ultimately broke this Japanese cipher machine, despite having never seen one, a picture of one, been able to take one apart. They just kind of guessed at it by looking at the garbled text that it spat out, and they were correct. They were able to break into this Japanese diplomatic machine called Purple, and in doing that, they got a window into what Japanese military and diplomats were thinking and planning to do in the war, and also a window into sort of Nazi strategy, because whenever Japanese diplomats would talk to their Nazi counterparts, William and his team were able to read the messages. And so this gave the Allies an incredible edge all through the war, and resulted in probably prevention of a lot of Allied deaths, and probably ended up shortening the war. So it was a huge success that William had with his army team. And meanwhile, while William was doing that, Elizabeth was working for a separate part of the government. she was working with a team at the Coast Guard. So remember, I said that, you know, between 1925 and 1931, she only had one person beneath her. In 1931, they finally allowed her to create a proper code-breaking team in the Coast Guard. And in World War II, that's where she was. She was working with this team that she had launched, that she had created, that she had built. She had trained the code-breakers. A lot of them were young men. They worked for her. She was their boss, which was incredibly unusual in the government, or really in all of society at the time, for a woman to be the boss of men as a technical leader. It was just unheard of. But she was unique. She was exceptional. And so she was leading these men, working on this team at the Coast Guard, and they were intercepting and solving the radio messages of Nazi spies who were creeping into the Western Hemisphere. Particularly in South America, setting up bases and clandestine radio stations. And Elizabeth's job and the job of her team was to do the same thing that she had done with the Rum War, to intercept these radio messages, solve them, and to try to figure out who these Nazi spies were and what they were doing, and ultimately how to try to stop them. And it's only because she had all of this Rum experience that that she was called upon to do this. It was kind of like an accident of history. Stuff happened. You know, it wasn't that she set out to hunt Nazi spies. It's just that the Nazi spies happened to be using very similar kinds of radio equipment and codes as the Rum Runners. And so when World War II came around, Elizabeth was ready to go. And there was no one else in government who had that ability. The FBI didn't have a code breaking team. All they had was essentially sort of like a crime lab where they analyzed bullet fragments and that sort of thing. And so the FBI was completely in the dark about what these Nazi spies were saying to each other in these secret clandestine radio messages. And so Elizabeth was ready to go, and she and her team monitored about 50 of these Nazi radio circuits, ultimately solved about 4,000 Nazi spy messages. So Elizabeth working at the Coast Guard, William working at the Army, and at the end of the day, they would go back home and they couldn't talk about what they were doing. And, you know, their joke was that, you know, for national security purposes, they had to sleep in separate beds. And it was a sad thing. They had to keep certain things in their life compartmentalized. And I think it was a burden for them, as you would imagine it would be for any couple, to not be able to talk about these things with each other and not be able to get that support. They'd always been so close, always had such an intimate kind of intellectual bond, and yet they had to keep these parts of their lives separate. And I think it ended up exacerbating a problem that became more severe for them as the years went on, which was William was a sick man. He was he suffered from probably bipolar disorder, and his mental health deteriorated during World War II. He was hospitalized for several months at Walter Reed General Hospital in the psychiatric ward after a mental breakdown after his team successfully broke purple. And for the rest of their lives, he would sort of spiral into periods of depression that were so severe that he had to be hospitalized and ultimately attempted electroshock therapy to try to get a handle on it. And I think that it was probably tougher for him because he wasn't able to talk about these things with the person in his life who was the most important to him, which was
Elizabeth. It seems like it had to have been really tough, because we learned very nicely that they spent so much of their time thinking with one brain while they were at Riverbank and developing all these things and having these co-joined timelines to finally get to where he and his team break purple and he can't talk about it. She's solved three Enigma machines during the war and put away all these Nazi conspiracies. They can't talk about that. And J. Edgar Hoover takes credit for everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and
what do you say? I mean, I think that's the central, you know, if there is a tragic element of their lives, I don't see them as tragic people. I feel like they're American heroes, wondrous, creative, original, personal heroes to me for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if there is a tragic element to their life, it's that by doing their duty for America, they were driven apart simply because they had to compartmentalize different aspects of their lives due to government regulations. And that is a sad thing. I write in the book that after the war, they found a way to combat that. And this is one of my favorite things about them, is that, after the war, they decided that they had been kept apart by their work for too long. They wanted to get back together and do a project together again and work together again. And so they did this very this thing to me that is very moving, which is they wrote a book together. I would find that moving because I'm a writer.
I write books, right?
But they wrote a book together called The Shakespeare Ciphers Examined. That is essentially, it's them going back into their past, going back into their early days at Riverbank, analyzing the theory of the crazy rich guy that there was secret messages hidden in the works of Shakespeare. Not only his theory, but the theories of all kinds of other people who believe similar things. And they one by one, Elizabeth and William kind of rip these theories apart in very kind of like polite diplomatic language. They just savage this whole class of ideas that there were hidden messages in Shakespeare. And it is a wonderful, I would recommend anybody to buy and read this book. It's really fun to read, wonderful, witty, like surprisingly hilarious at times. And that's how they got back to each other after the trauma of the wars, is that they wrote this book together about Shakespeare and kind of getting their revenge on the lunatic Gilded Age tycoon who originally kind of made their lives difficult.
I wrote down that you wrote the Freedmans wrote with a ruthless honesty because that's who they were as people.
Yes, always. Their personal motto was knowledge is power, which was a statement of Francis Bacon. who was supposedly the guy who had written Shakespeare. They didn't believe that, but they liked Bacon's motto, knowledge is power. William adopted that as his own creed, and I think Elizabeth believed it too, to the extent that when William died in 1969, Elizabeth had that motto carved on his headstone in Arlington mm-hmm. National Cemetery, and she's buried in the same plot. And so when you go and visit the Freedmen's gravesite today, and you look at the headstone, what you see is that motto, knowledge is power. They just did not give an inch their entire lives in the pursuit of truth. They were honest, ruthlessly honest about their own work in a way that I think is really inspiring and mm-hmm. And reflects and shows that they are scientists, right? You guys are scientists. I mean, would you say that this is one of the central things, as I understand it, about the scientist's creed, right? Is that you have to be honest with yourself first and foremost.
Well, Feynman would always tell us that science is not perfect, but it's the best way we have to keep from fooling ourselves. Absolutely. And if anybody understood that, it had to be the Freedmans, who had to avoid just making crap up out of the secret messages they were trying to read. They had the Shakespeare things that they finally decided were crap. Elizabeth had to go to court and convince people that she wasn't just making things up. If anybody could be susceptible to seeing, you know, making things up and seeing crap and stuff, it's got to be code breakers. And they were, you're right, they were pretty ruthless and tough with themselves about avoiding that.
Yeah, honestly, and in over the last couple of years of researching this book, I've felt that the culture is moving in the other direction.
they're dangerous. Yeah,
you read the news, and you definitely see the dangers of believing what you want to believe and tricking yourself into seeing what you want to see. And so, for me, learning about the Freedmans, reading their letters, reading their papers was. You know, it was a balm. It was a comfort. So
are you saying that Elizabeth's story has relevance for modern readers in today's times?
I may be saying that.
Well, you know,
I wouldn't want to do anything. Yeah.
The whole thing of women in STEM is, just to show there's this woman, and you do not shy away from saying she's got two kids and how she doted on them to the extent she did while conducting this job. And I felt like, you know, she sort of had it all, you know?
Yeah. I think, she would go and she would take the train, she would testify against gangsters on the witness stand, in the pink dress and the flower pinned to the hat. Then she would take the train back home and, take her kids out to Saturday morning tea and do crossword puzzles with them.
So you've included many letters to the children back and forth between them. And it was just such a marvelous picture of the woman. The entire book is really good. And I'm really glad you wrote it. And I do want to get back to, the fact that you wrote these two very different books to this one. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like this book is more of a fit, or do you feel like you're just constantly changing and, your next book could be completely different again?
I've always sort of responded to the material in my career. You have, as a writer, as a researcher, a kind of visceral or instinctive reaction mm-hmm. to material that you discover. And, I had that the very first day I started reading Elizabeth's letters. Her voice on the page just leapt out at me. It was so funny, witty, warm, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes very bitchy, appealingly so. And I just felt that this was a story that had to be told. And the more I dug, it kept on opening into these, stranger and more surprising worlds, which is what you want to have happen as a writer. You want your subject to start feeling bigger and bigger instead of smaller and smaller. And that happened. Like you said, stuff happened and stuff kept happening. And, I got to the point a couple of times where, I was looking for a trove of documents I wasn't sure if I could find. Then I would be there in the library, and I would find something and I would realize what it was. And you're sitting in a special collections room. All the people around you have their lights and they're very sort of, you know, their station set up just show, and it's very quiet, and you just want to scream in excitement and be like, yeah, you wouldn't believe what I just have here. And you can't do that because people will yell at you.
Yeah.
But there were moments like that kept occurring all throughout the research process, which told me I was kind of on the right track. And honestly was really motivating and pushed me toward the finish line to complete this thing, get the story out and get people reading it and hopefully talking about it.
And not to be too ridiculous about it, but she is a story for the times that not only did it come about that enough things were declassified and available that you could research the story, but it seems like we might be in an unusually good position right now to hear a really good story about someone as interesting and influential and necessary as Elizabeth Friedman.
I think so. I think a couple of things came together. One was that the records were declassified, and another is that I like you said, I think people are ready to hear stories mm-hmm. like this. I think it's important to tell the stories of women and people of color who've been ignored and suppressed throughout history. I also think it's just the more accurate version of what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just what happened. Women were there. Yeah. Whenever you look back in the historical documents, women were there doing this technical work. And I think Elizabeth is a really powerful mm-hmm. example of that. Is that she was there doing this. At a time when women weren't thought to be capable of doing it, and she was doing it at the very highest level. And mm-hmm. And one reason that we never heard about her before is simply because the story was omitted or sometimes suppressed by powerful men around her.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Amazing. So we've got 2 minutes left. Is there anything that you wanted to bring up that we didn't raise as a question to you before we sign out?
I don't think so. I feel like that was
you did a great job.
I feel like that was pretty fun. That was really fun. I feel like you covered all the bases and did it in a nice organic way, and I'm glad that you guys reached out. It's great to talk to scientists, and I really appreciate your support of it. Thank you so
much. Have we convinced people, Joanne and Jason, have we convinced people that they want to read this book and learn about Elizabeth and William Friedman now?
I hope so. Like I said, I loved it. It's really ranking in one of my top books this year, just by the fact that I just didn't want to put it down. And I felt like you had a good message and you told it so well.
Cool. Thank you. So, I mean, that means a lot to me. And, I hope that people watching this will buy it. I mean, I'm trying not to get too promotional here.
Holidays are good. No, holidays are coming up. So
yeah, it's a good gift.
Yeah, I think so. Do you think you'll write another biography now that you've tackled this one, or?
Not for a while. It's hard. It's pretty difficult. No, I don't have an idea for another one right now.
He's totally indifferent. Something will come along that will spark his interest.
Yeah,
we know exactly. That.
And before you know it, the story will start growing.
Probably so. Probably. Exactly. I hope.
It's wonderful. Well, everybody. We are so glad Jason could come by and help talk about the book, The Woman Who Smashed Codes. And I love the cover. You know, I try not to comment on covers because they say you can't judge a book by the cover, but I love this one.
Yeah, they did a beautiful job, I think.
It was very nice. Very, very nice. So thank you, Jason, for coming on, and thank you for writing the book. I'm so glad.
Thank you, Joanne. It was a very enjoyable spot
in my year. So, and we all need it.
Yep. Wonderful. Right. Yeah, I had a great time. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us on Read Science, and we'll see you again soon.
Bye-bye.